2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenthal.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back again with our daily dose of Sherlock Holmes. We are in the midst of a study in Scarlet. This is chapter three today.
Chapter three, Steve. Chapter three, Pam. This is exciting.
It is. We have now landed on the mystery after doing a few other things first.
Well, you have to have an introduction. And we've said it so many times the last 2 days. Doyle has introduced these characters so well that, yeah, now we're getting into the introduction of the mystery.
Oh, certainly. And what I wanted to point out is that this is a very tight book so far. So we're in chapter three. We got that introduction to Watson and his introduction to Holmes. We got the 221 Baker Street set up in chapter two, and chapter three is really about we're going to go on our first adventure with Holmes, and we're going to watch him use his knowledge, we're going to watch him use his skills, and we're going to compare those to the police officers out there that are calling him in. We know Holmes is better. The officers know it. Watson knows it. The readers know it. And we want to know, is it arrogance or is it competence? We're going to find out.
Or is it both? And of course, because this novel appeared all in one piece, it's unlike the Baskervilles where people had to wait for a month. Here, it's sort of seamless, right? It goes straight from one to the next.
And that changes the writing style for sure. When we watch a two-hour movie, there's not going to be a cliffhanger every 20 minutes, but if it's an episodic short story format TV show, then yeah, it has to have a beginning, middle, and end. These chapters don't necessarily need that, but they kind of have that though.
They have it, but not as strongly as Baskervilles, I think.
Because it didn't need to.
Exactly. Yep. So in the opening to chapter three, Watson is torn between admiration and suspicion. And this is something that we're going to see like a million characters experience when they meet Sherlock Holmes and he tells them something he shouldn't know about them. So here's Watson. He sees Sherlock has just said, oh, this guy's a Marine, not wearing his uniform. So here's how Watson feels about it. I confess that I was considerably startled by this fresh proof of the practical nature of my companion's theories. My respect for his powers of analysis increased wondrously. There still remained some lurking suspicion in my mind, however, that the whole thing was a prearranged episode intended to dazzle me, though what earthly object he could have in taking me in was past my comprehension. So he's just like, did this guy prearrange? Is this like a play?
But why did you do this? Is this Doyle looking at the audience and thinking that they might think that and trying to give the right background to who Holmes is here?
Ooh, I like that. I like that. Like Watson's representing us and saying, are we supposed to buy this or not buy this? But he really has no reason for playing a trick on us.
Right.
Yet.
I love Holmes's explanation when Watson's like, wait, how did you do that? And Holmes says, you know what? Sometimes it's easier to know stuff than to explain it. Like if I ask you, does 2 + 2 = 4? You're like, oh, well, of course it does. But if you have to explain it with a mathematical proof, it's sort of hard.
Right.
Wonderful, I ejaculated. Commonplace, said Holmes, though I thought from his expression that he was pleased at my evident surprise and admiration. Aw, this is
right there. There it is, right there. He is pleased. Maybe not as exuberantly pleased as he will be later on in the stories, but he shows that he likes to be admired.
Yeah. And so he's arrogant, but there's like a sort of lack of self-confidence out of it as well. That's so charming.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Then we get, of course, there's an American in this story.
Steve, he's from the mistake by the lake.
Cleveland. Poor Cleveland.
The sad part of Cleveland. I don't know if you read it a few years ago. But there's always a good obituary somewhere. But a gentleman wrote, before he passed away, that he wanted the Cleveland Browns, the football team, to lay him down into his grave so they could let him down one more time.
Oh. Poor Cleveland. Cleveland never gets a good story, does it? So this guy's name is Enoch J. Drebler. Enoch J. Drebler. That's a not made up name.
I think that's all ready for a Disney film right there. Good Lord. So he's dead. So our readers want to know that. And so all we need to know is there's a little background on Enoch. It may mean nothing. It may mean something. Steve, all that Catholic training you got as a young boy, I'm sure it made you think of the book of Genesis. And there's two Enochs mentioned there. One was the son of Cain. And Cain, of course, was banished because he killed his brother. So he was the first son of Cain. And the other one was a son of Noah, who walked with God, and he was no more, for God took him, which is interpreted for some that he entered heaven as a living person as opposed to as a person who's passed away. We know this Enoch is going to pass away, and he's going to have some grotesque looks on his face.
There are different models of detection at play here. We get some ideas about what Scotland Yard is doing.
Oh, yeah. And you guys, of course, in 1887, as I've mentioned before, there's a lot of anxiety in the US and in the UK about police detectives and also this sort of new group of private or amateur detectives. And so here, you know, all the way through the Holmes stories, we're going to get some really interesting relationships between the consulting detective and the police detectives. But here, there's a rivalry at Scotland Yard. So it's not Lestrade who writes to Holmes about this. It's Tobias Gregson. So Holmes says to Watson, Gregson is the smartest of the Scotland Yarders. He and Lestrade are the pick of a bad lot. They are both quick and energetic, but conventional, shockingly so. They have their knives into one another too. They are as jealous as a pair of professional beauties. There will be some fun over this case if they are both put onto the scent.
That's one of my favorite lines of this chapter, for sure. As jealous as a pair of professional beauties. That says it all.
You know, as a father of two daughters, and Pam, you're the mother of two daughters, this is not the kind of comment I would make across the dinner table.
No.
But it certainly conjures a very specific image, and you know that is shorthand for this relationship.
Now, I love the descriptions of these two. So Gregson is a tall, white-faced, flaxen-haired man, and Lestrade is lean and ferret-like as ever.
So which one of these are we supposed to like, and which one are we not supposed
to like?
Well,
there's the tall, younger, good-looking one, and then there's the like little weaselly older one. And
they both
got nothing on home.
Now he's a ferret. It's
yeah. He's gonna be with Watson. You know, going to therapy right after. You know.
Now, the young Sherlock Holmes is not quite accepting that he's going to get no credit if he solves this case, right? Now, as we see him mature, he, you know, in later stories and even in Baskerville Hall, he's like, oh yeah, hey, I was happy to help out. You guys take the credit. I like to work behind the scenes. But here, when Watson's like, oh my goodness, you're going to have to go help, Holmes says, my dear fellow, what does it matter to me? Supposing I unravel the whole matter, you may be sure that Gregson, Lestrade, and company will pocket all the credit. That comes of being an unofficial personage. And so, yeah, this is a young Holmes who is a little bit seeking attention.
But that whole unofficial personage thing has come up so many times in the short stories. And there it is, right there. It amazes me every time Doyle brings up one of these traits that we have identified over the, you know, 56 short stories that we haven't read all of them, but so many. But here it is in the very beginning.
Yep. And then Holmes also says about Gregson, he knows that I am his superior and acknowledges it to me, but he would cut his tongue out before he would own it to any third person. So this just annoys Holmes that Gregson realizes that Holmes is the one who does all the solving, but won't give him credit in front of anyone else. Holmes very deliberately makes fun of Gregson and Lestrade. Did you guys have some good laughs in this chapter?
Oh, yeah.
there's more zoomorphism and more animal imagery here.
Well, there is that.
Well, it's like they did it's like the police did everything wrong. You know, you walk up, everything's a big mess.
Right.
It's like, oh yeah, look at this. This will be helpful.
And I like the very first when they first arrive at the scene and Gregson says, "I have had everything left untouched. Except that," my friend answered, pointing at the pathway. "If a herd of buffaloes had passed along, there could not be a greater mess." And then Gregson's is like, "Oh, yeah, you know, Lestrade was in charge of the outdoors." And then
he immediately throws him under the bus.
Right, 100%.
There's a few beauties, right? He's a ferret. So, you know.
And Holmes says, "With two such men as yourself and Lestrade upon the ground, there will not be much for a third party to find out," he said. Gregson rubbed his hands in a self-satisfied way. "I think we have done all that can be done," he answered. And of course, we, the reader, realize there's not going to be much to find because they stepped on everything. Not going to be much to mine because they gathered all the evidence.
Right. That's what he means. You guys have ruined. Yeah. I love the hand rubbing. That is one of my favorite British things. It's shorthand. Again, if you see a British person, generally a man, rubbing his hands, that is a signal of joy. It's one of my favorite things from Fawlty Towers. Whenever Basil Fawlty was excited about something, pleased about something that he did, he was always seen rubbing his hands. I love that imagery. It's so easy, but it's three times in this chapter.
And of course, Lestrade is super pleased with himself when he finds the word rache, R-A-C-H-E, scrawled in the victim's blood on the wall. And he says, "Oh, there's a woman named Rachel involved." And Holmes bursts into laughter.
It's so silly. It reminds me of Monty Python, where, the castle, Well, if he died while he was writing it, he wouldn't have written the word ah.
Now, by the way, the BBC Sherlock does some super amazing script writing with the word rache in their Study in Scarlet takeoff. But anyway, so Lestrade says, "It's all very well for you to laugh, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. You may be very smart and clever, but the old hound is the best when all is said and done." "I really beg your pardon," said my companion, who had ruffled the little man's temper by bursting into an explosion of laughter. And so Holmes, you know, he can't help but laugh, but then he is gracious about it.
It's funny how Lestrade thinks that he's so much older and wiser than Sherlock Holmes in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
And that bloodhound again, the old hound is the best.
Yeah, I don't think there's much age discrepancy there, though, right?
Oh, I think there is. I think Lestrade, like, in his 40s, and Holmes and Watson are in their 20s. Or that's how I read it. You know what? It never says exactly how old he is. I just assume Gregson's the younger one and Lestrade's older. But I don't know. It's a good
one. I would think that Lestrade, just I don't know. That's from our readings of the short stories, comes across as, you know, not significantly senior, but certainly a few more years, a little more experience. At least Lestrade in his own mind feels that he is super prepared for Holmes.
I've never thought of this before. It's never crossed my mind that he might be slightly older. In all of the representations on television, they seem to be about the same age, the actors. Yeah. So, whatever. There's so many tropes. The tropes just keep on coming in this chapter.
Yes, the victim, the expression on the victim's face, we've seen this many times, right? So when Watson looks down, the murdered man has an expression of horror and hatred. And I really like the line that Watson closes the description of the murdered man with. He says, "I have seen death in many forms, but never has it appeared to me in a more fearsome aspect than in that dark, grimy apartment, which looked out upon one of the main arteries of suburban London." And I think here, he's thinking about, you know, he's been to war and as a doctor. So he has seen death in that context. But somehow when death is inside an apartment in London and you're seeing the city outside. And then you have that sort of moment of war, which is right in the center of the center of your civilization. There's something very powerful and probably evocative for Watson, who really has described a PTSD situation in the chapter.
I had that same feeling when I was reading through that, where I knew that, you know, Watson was a military doctor. He had seen certainly some things that were very gruesome. And here we are in an apartment and he's describing it as being more intense than that type of situation.
And I had missed the whole it's out of place part. I was just thinking that it was the idea of murder versus the idea of death in war, which you come to expect. I mean, that's kind of the thing that you do in war. But in murder, that's where I thought he was making that point. But you're right. It is about place.
The mind's never prepared for that.
Right. And in your own home, right? That's where you feel safe.
Yeah.
If you are on the battlefield, you don't feel safe. So, I mean, yeah, I think all of those things are at play. And the fact when he mentions suburban London, you're supposed to feel safe in suburban London, right?
We have more zoomorphism. We've already talked about Lestrade, described as a lean ferret-like. He was rat-faced last chapter. We'll see which of the weasel family we get in chapter 4. There is another character who's described as a singularly simious and ape-like appearance.
That's the murdered man, our friend Enoch Debler.
Okay. An ape-like creature from Cleveland.
Yes.
He may be part silverback. I don't know.
There you go.
And then Sherlock himself, and then we've had Lestrade describing himself as a bloodhound, and Sherlock, when he investigates the scene, it's kind of a funny scene, right? Where he's like muttering under his breath. He's apparently forgetting anyone is watching. As I watched him, I was irresistibly reminded of a pure-blooded, well-trained foxhound as it dashes backward and forward through the covert, whining in its eagerness until it comes across the lost scent. So this is the first time of many, many times in the canon that we see Holmes described as sometimes a bloodhound, this specific foxhound, which is really one of the cuter hounds. I looked it up. It's a very attractive dog. And he's using that sort of instinct to find the scent of the murder here.
Sherlock's attention to detail is on display here. He is definitely checking out what he needs to see and seeing with a different perspective from everybody else.
Well, this is the part where we're starting to get, when we say the tropes of how we would, you're going to costume your Sherlock Holmes. He's got the magnifying glass. They use the magnifying glass all the time when they're using Sherlock Holmes.
Because it is certainly one of those symbols of Sherlock. He is the first detective to employ that magnifying glass in investigations. Sherlock says, "They say that genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains," he remarked with a smile. It's a very bad definition, but it does apply to detective work. He sees himself as a genius because he's taking the time to search the scene in a way that the police are not.
You know, he's not only taking the time to search this scene, but he also... this is what he's preparing for, right? This is what, when we go back to Watson's list in chapter 2, this is what Sherlock spends his time on, is developing his painstaking understanding of anatomy, of geology, of botany. And so, and most importantly, of sensational literature and crime. So I love this line where he says, after looking things over, "It reminds me of the circumstances attendant on the death of Van Jensen in Utrecht in the year 34. Do you remember the case, Gregson?" "No, sir." "Read it up. You really should. There's nothing new under the sun. It has all been done before."
Oh, my God.
1834. That was like 55 years ago. And so, of course, Gregson, none of them, but he has done the reading. He knows the kinds of crimes that can happen. He has this encyclopedic knowledge of all the different narratives of crime that are out there. And this is his painstaking genius, right?
of obscure, long forgotten, you know, murders.
All right, but Chip, you know, if you study history, you know that a lot of things that we see today are not new. This has just been done before. And if you know the history, you might not repeat it. And those of us who don't know the history, we might be doomed to repeat it because we don't know any better.
Et tu, Brute?
Oh, the Ides of March. Remember the Ides of March when we almost went to school? We get here the profile of the murderer from Holmes's perspective.
And Holmes really loves to look over the scene and say, well, guys, I can't tell you much, but write this down, just a couple little quick details. And then he goes ahead with this super detailed description. The murderer was a man. He was more than 6 feet high, was in the prime of his life, had small feet for his height, wore coarse square-toed boots, and smoked a trichinopolique cigar. He came here with his victim in a four-wheeled cab, which was drawn by a horse with three old shoes and one new one on his off foreleg. In all probability, the murderer has a florid face, and the fingernails of his right hand were remarkably long. These are only a few indications, but they may assist you.
I don't know much, but here's
a perfect description with like a lot of details you can't even imagine how I came up with.
Good Lord.
But think about, you know, like 30 years later, we're getting the description of the woman with the pince-nez. You know, we're getting the description of Captain Crocker based on how he tied a knot. Like, this is one of those things that we love about the Sherlock Holmes stories, is his ability to give us a really accurate profile that we can't even imagine how he came up with.
And now we come to our favorite part of the show. It's called the ending. Pam's favorite.
The listener's favorite.
It's like folk music. When does it end?
So Lestrade says, if this man was murdered, how was it done? Poison, said Sherlock Holmes curtly, and strode off. One other thing, Lestrade, he added, turning round at the door. Rache is the German for revenge, so don't lose your time looking for Miss Rachel. With which Parthian shot, he walked away, leaving the two rivals open-mouthed behind him. Yeah. Friend. I had to look up Parthian shot. Did you guys?
Yeah, I absolutely did. And it's very interesting that this is another one of those phrases that was misheard, misunderstood enough times to change it into a different phrase in English. The Parthian shot was a method of shooting from horseback a bow and arrow behind somebody toward the people that you're trying to evade, a Parthian shot. It was an ancient Iranian military tactic.
Okay.
But nobody says Parthian shot, right? We say parting shot.
Right.
Parting shot, the shot that we give as we are leaving, just as Holmes does here. But
the drop the mic moment, right?
Right, but as you're walking out the door, as you literally turn around, as you're walking out the door and say something, drop the mic and walk out. Parting shot, which doesn't make as much sense as Parthian shot, but exactly. That's where language changes.
Well, you know, I'm standing here slack-jawed as you said that, Steve.
Just staring, wondering when the next episode will come on.
This little drool coming out of the mouth.
We said that this all came out at the same time, Christmas of 1887, but this is definitely a stinger ending for the end of this episode, the end of this chapter.
Oh, this is awesome.
Well, and I really like how he describes, I mean, that's such a great Parthian shot. And then he describes the two rivals. They leave the two rivals open up behind them. So that's how we're supposed to think of Lestrade and Gregson, right? Mm-hmm. Like these two detectives, and we know who's going to win, Sherlock Holmes. But the rivalry between them makes for just a really interesting dynamic within the police system.
Sure.
This is so good. This is such a great piece of this mystery. We have the introduction of both the murdered man and this profile of the murder suspect to go look out for in chapter 4.
Are you going to be looking for Miss Rachel?
Ah, the castle. Ah, no. Ah, from the back of the throat. Oh. You guys get more nerdy. My nerd friends got that joke. They were laughing loudly.
Isn't there some sort of Geek Day coming up?
Yes, Monday. Monday is Geek Pride Day. Join us on geekpride.net for all of the fun that we're going to have with all the people that'll get my jokes. You people.
Those people, Steve? Those people?
What does he mean, you people? This has been great. I hope everybody's having as much fun with this as we're having. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Go to our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes to follow all the fun from around the world. And go to our new website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of our fun conversations, all collected together for your convenience. Join us tomorrow as we get into chapter 4, where I'm sure we'll see more of the Sherlock Holmes tropes one after the other. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasselhoff.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich? So we don't talk about what I want to talk about. It's what I want to thank you for. What I want to thank you for.
I make no comments.
That's a dream I had once.